Welcome back to Word Up with Dani Katz. I am your host, Dani Katz. I am an author, journalist, and a quantum languaging coach and consultant. What that means is that I teach people how language programs consciousness, how language programs reality at large, and how to transform reality and evolve our consciousness with language. I've also been known to cultivate and share an opinion or two or 12 about culture and consciousness and how they are evolving, devolving, and being manipulated by the powers that were. Here at Word Up, we are devoted to fostering critical thinking while supporting you in becoming your most authentic, empowered, liberated, realized, amazing version of yourself. Our every show aims to expand your consciousness, raise your frequency, sharpen your critical thinking skills, and make you giggle. And think. Given the radical uptick in censorship over the past few years, combined with the complete co-opting slash decimation of my own personal industry, journalism, I started Word Up to have a free speech-friendly platform in which to engage exploratory, solutions-based conversations with visionaries, mystics, original thinkers, and rebel badasses who are helping to make the world more wonderful. The first half of my interviews run between 30 to 90 minutes and are always posted here for free public listening. The second halves are reserved for paid supporters on my Patreon and my Locals platforms, where for as little as $5 a month, you can access all of my second half conversations along with oodles of other bonus content and opportunities to drop in with me, to drop in with our High Vibe tribe, and lots of other awesome things. In addition to interviews, Word Up also features quantum languaging upgrades, planetary service announcements, and propaganda analysis, which I call Spot the Propaganda. Thank you so much for tuning in and for sharing your sacred attention with me and our High Vibe tribe of change makers. Be sure to click that subscribe button so you can stay abreast of our every episode. Thank you for also clicking the like button, for sharing far and wide, and for leaving some kind words as a review as you are authentically inspired. As well, if you are gleaning any value whatsoever from these shows, consider supporting me on Locals and or Patreon. And as you are wanting to learn more about my quantum languaging coaching and consulting services or nab copies of my books, find me on DaniKatz.com as well as on quantumlanguaging.com. Okay, I think that's it for our housekeeping. Buckle up and prepare to enjoy this episode of Word Up with Dani Katz. Hey, superstars, welcome back to another episode of Word Up with Dani Katz. Today I am joined by me because I'm solo podcasting today. Today we're going to be focusing mostly on the language of victimhood straight from my brand new book. Is it still brand new? I'm going to say it's still brand new. The Language of Betterarchy. And before we get into it, I have some kind of disparate thoughts that I feel inspired to share, to get off my chest. Actually, scratch that. After recording this episode and editing, I realized the things that I wanted to get off my chest were infinitely more appropriate for the post-show throwdown videos that I share with my paying supporters on Locals and Patreon. So I cut that out. I moved it to the part of the show that posts on Locals and Patreon, and all in service to sharing the meat of the matter, which is the language of betterarchy concept with you guys in the public sphere. All right, buckle up, here goes. I want to talk to us about victim consciousness today. And it's been on my mind. It's actually been on my podcast list to talk about this singular languaging upgrade, because I think of everything that I talk about in terms of languaging, this one might be the most valuable, the most transformative, and the most life-changing.
But before I get to it, I'm going to give you a little bit of background. I'm going to give you a little bit of a personal window into my path that I haven't really shared much. But again, another long story short, in my 20s, I was under psychiatric care at UCLA Neuropsych. I was never inpatient. I was never like at a facility. I was never committed. Like I was never a danger of myself. It wasn't anything like that. It was just around fluctuating moods, which at this point I realized like I'm a big person. I run a lot of energy. I run a lot of life force. I have a very big capacity for creativity and expression, and that doesn't necessarily align with the kind of contracted realm of comfort that our Western medical paradigm attempts to put upon a pedestal called normal while pathologizing everything else that falls outside of those boundaries, right? But I was in my 20s, I didn't understand these things. And I had a whole team of psychiatrists at UCLA Neuropsych tell me that I would never live a normal life, that I would never be able to keep a job, and that my only hope was to run away to Costa Rica or Thailand or one of those like kind of less expensive, more low-key hippie expat lifestyles instead of trying to make it work in this realm where it would never work for me. And I responded to that the way I respond to every single time the Western medical paradigm attempts to place a limitation on me, which is just watch me, right? And small example of that was I tore all my wrist cartilage when I was a gymnast. And I had it all, you know, the pieces that I had left in my wrist were all cut out. And so it was very hard for me to put my wrist back, right? To do a push-up or a down dog or a handstand. And I had one of my orthopedic surgeons tell me, you're never gonna be able to do that. And I was like, yeah, watch me. Like, I love it when people in positions of so-called authority tell me that I'm never going to be able to do something. It's like the swiftest way to get me to do that thing is tell me that I can't do it. So as soon as they said that to me, I mean, I'd already had my suspicions with the sort of psychiatric model, but I just thought that's an excuse. None of that is true. And I'm going to prove you wrong. And so it was not, you know, I had already started my spiritual journey years and years before that. And I'd already started working on myself and I'd already started, you know, using tools and stepping into different modalities, but it became a lot more prioritized at that point. And that's when I dove into all the things: somatic experiencing, polarity therapy, inner child work, family constellations, sweat lodges, you know, that's when I started doing 10-day Vipassana retreats. I was hardcore Ashtanga yogi. I got into, of course, psychedelics, started working with shamans and mystics and African divinators and working with my ancestors. I mean, if there was a modality out there, I was going to try it, right? And it was just looking for like anything that I could gather to help me master myself, knowing that there was nothing fundamentally wrong with me, but that for whatever reason, the universe had loaded me up with a ton of stuff, a ton of life force, a ton of sensitivity, a ton of really big emotions, a ton of trauma, a ton of past life stuff. You know, like I just had a lot to work with. And on this end of my journey, I just look back and it's like, yeah, it's like I had a machete and was trying to get through like the thickest possible forest. And there were years and decades of clear cutting before I could get to the point where I had some perspective and see what was really going on with me and what I'm really dealing with and start to develop tools and master tools and get a little bit more nuanced, right? And I think a lot of people are slapped with these ridiculously abusive curses called pathologies when they're really just like exceptional people with a lot of creativity and a lot going on, and these like singular practitioners don't know how to deal with it, and so they just slap on these pathologies. But my point is that With all of that work, and I'm talking about like diligent, like I was always doing something. I was always working with, you know, a therapist, a coach, a mystic, a practitioner, a this, a that. I was in this course, I was in this workshop, I was doing this thing. And I gleaned value. Don't get me wrong. I gleaned a ton of value. You know, Vipassana meditation has been incredibly valuable. Inner child work, family constellation work, like those are in the top. But ultimately, what really did it for me was the languaging. And what I've realized on this, you know, at this point in my journey, because it continues, is that I developed this body of work for myself because I was so desperate to shift my mindset, to shift my relationship to abundance, to security, to victimhood, to other humans. And while I gleaned value from most everything that I dipped my toe in, the secret sauce that really did it for me was my own work, was my own languaging paradigm. And so I realize on this end of it that I created this body of work for myself. And to this day, it's what I'm most grateful for and what I attribute the most of my transformation, evolution, continuing mastery. I attribute it to this languaging work. And when, you know, when there have been times when I've fallen back into darker head spaces, more hopelessness, victim consciousness, victim mentality, what gets me out of it every time is me doing my own work, me reading my own books, me really being diligent with my languaging and utilizing the tools that I've created. And so I share this with you guys today because I shared it with one of my clients recently. And I could tell that it was impactful for her. And I've really steered clear of sharing my own story because I get bored of it. I get bored of hearing other people share their stories, especially other coaches and consultants. But I felt like, you know what, for the record, let's put it on the record. This is why, I walk the path that I walk, and this is why I have so much allegiance to this languaging work because it has been the biggest game changer for me in terms of changing how I'm languaging my circumstances, thus changing how I'm programming my subconscious mind as well as the world around me. And I bring this up today specifically because we're talking about victim consciousness, because I am still in the process of transmuting those tendencies to delve into victim consciousness. And I created an entire writing career around all these terrible, sucky things that happened to me. And if you're listening with your ears, I'm making quote marks because that is victim languaging. So it's, you know, it took a lot of effort for me to back myself out of that corner I painted myself in called victimhood. And, you know, like I said, I'm still in the process of mastering it. I understand very well victim consciousness, right? I understand why people lean into victim consciousness. Thinking that, oh, if people feel sorry for us, if we can drum up enough pity, then maybe they'll help us. But it all rests on this fiction of external authority, right? Wherein we're constantly reaching outside of ourselves for validation, for empathy, for compassion, for, you know, a fix, for a solution instead of turning inward. And so with this in mind, I'm going to read us some pieces from the victim consciousness, excuse me, the victimhood chapter of the Language of Betterarchy. Now, the victimhood chapter is the longest chapter by far in part three of the book. Part three features the 10 markers of hierarchical languaging. The reason the victimhood chapter is so long is because victimhood is such a blight on our culture. It's the real deal pandemic, if there is one, is the continued pushing of this fiction that attempts to convince us that there's value in victimhood and that being the most oppressedest somehow translates to a life well lived when it does the exact opposite. So I notice I have a tendency to do this sometimes when I'm like, when we're delving into betterarchy, I sometimes have the inclination to just summarize what I've written. So I'm getting back into the practice of reading what I've written because I put so much time and care into crafting it in the just right way. So it's silly that I wouldn't just make it easy on myself by reading what I worked so hard on instead of trying to restate it. So we're going to jump around a little bit, but here goes. Hierarchies, social engineers have gone the distance in convincing the collective that there is value in victimhood. This fallacious and ridiculous notion has people clawing, fighting, and scrambling for most marginalized status because we've been suckered into believing that disempowerment is the new black and that most oppressedist is a title worth lobbying for. The rub is that while the most oppressedist might win sympathy and a certain kind of low vibe social status, the claim doesn't come along with any actual real lived value. Sure, victims are rewarded with pity, sympathy, handouts, tisks, tisks, furrowed brows, concerned coos, and all the emotional junk food upon which we binge when we're not resourced enough to know ourselves whole and empowered. But none of these external reactions translate to a robust, abundant, creative, fulfilling incarnation. Victimhood is a tiny, contracted, go-nowhere corner into which we paint ourselves. Cheered on, read enabled, by friends, follows, likes, and social credit. Victimhood is the crutch that allows us to rationalize shrunken, lackluster lives, while blaming excuse X or perpetrator Y for our crummy lot and our unrealized potential. I'm going to skip the next part, which is about victimhood in the feminine shadow. It will make much more sense when you read the actual book, given that part one is all about the myth of patriarchy. All right, moving on to the oppression Olympics. And for those listening with their ears, I'm sharing some of the cute illustrations. All right. Hierarchy loves it some victim consciousness because a society full of disempowered people is easy to control. And a society full of disempowered people fragmented into tiny identitarian subgroups, fighting over who wins most marginalized status while blaming and shaming each other for their plight, well, that's the divide and rule jackpot. 21st century hierarchy has gifted us an imaginary, though strictly socially enforced, marginalization rating scale that alleges we can quantify adversity based upon a handful of superficial character traits: race, religion, gender, skin color, sexual preference, et al. This surface level scale of implied suffering seeks to convince us that people with lighter skin necessarily suffer less than people with darker skin do, period and always, and that people with darker skin and gender dysmorphia necessarily suffer more than people with darker skin without gender dysmorphia because, well, melanin. This same victimization rating scale alleges that women suffer more than men, homosexuals suffer more than heterosexuals, and on and on and on. Skewed by this shallow, reductive means of assessing something as multi-layered and immeasurable as suffering, disregards other contributing factors and considerations, such as trauma, tragedy, illness, injury, family, geography, neurology, environment, circumstance et al. When competing in the oppression Olympics, these are all but inconsequential irrelevancies that count for nothing because melanin and pronouns and vaginas and ugh. I'm going to let you in on a little secret the social engineers don't want us to know. I suggest pulling on your big girl, big boy panties for this one, because if you've swallowed the latest batch of ideological indoctrination, you may very well be triggered. Everybody suffers. Now, this is not to deny anyone's trauma, tragedy, pain, or plight on any level whatsoever. People endure some really fucked up shit on this planet, which is essentially a swiftly spinning rock hurtling through unexplored realms of deeper and deeper space at a breakneck pace. As if this wasn't unsettling enough, this spinning rock we call home happens to be populated by deadly plants, predators, microbes, and pathogens. Along with ass-kicking terrain and deep-sea God knows what, while also being predisposed to epic environmental upheavals and buttloads of hard knocks and unfair licks for those of us making our homes upon it. Nothing about this setup is safe, nor was it ever meant to be. Granted, it can appear as though some people suffer more than others do. Look at countries like Haiti and India. Look at the entire African continent. Look at Flint, Michigan. Why are some people born into poverty upon parched pieces of earth marked by famine, violence, and corruption, while some are born in peaceful, resource-rich paradises? I can't answer this with any certainty. What I do know is that no one has exclusive rights to suffering. Everybody suffers, regardless of race, gender, skin color, or belief structure. Everyone is blessed with gifts and talents and boosts and boons, while also given their share of shadows, burdens, and short sticks. I don't know how it's all doled out or what factors determine who gets what, but I do know that we all get a mix of all of it, the good, the bad, the ugly, and the wonderful. Victimizing ourselves to the challenges we are dealt amplifies the weight and power of said challenges. The more we talk about our challenges and lament our challenges and define our lives and our lot by our challenges, the heavier and more cumbersome these challenges become. The language of victimhood seeps into our vocabulary in a hefty handful of subtle and insidious ways. The implications are many and varied, but at its most basic level, the more we talk about our sad stories and all the terrible things that happen to us, the more life and legitimacy we give to these frequencies, simultaneously empowering them and seeding our collective field with them, thereby creating more experiences that match those very same frequencies. This is not to advocate rug shoving, repression, or denial. It is important that we acknowledge our suffering and that we take the time and care necessary to process and integrate our suffering such that we are not inclined to attach or identify and thus give these experiences any more power over us than they have already leached. There is a time and a place for telling our stories, like with trusted healers, guides, friends, and family who can hold space and support us in milking these experiences for the lessons and upgrades they hold for us, and in integrating them such that they do not run or define our lives. All right, there's a text box here for the triggered. And I'm gonna read it. You know what? I'm just gonna read it and then we're gonna take a pause. Some folks seem to get their panties in a great big bunch at the suggestion that we not identify certain groups as victims because, according to the panty bunchers, said groups have had it so bad that to deny their victimhood is tantamount to a hate crime. And while it may be true that there are particular groups that really did or do have it way worse than any other historically marginalized groups, the laws of reality creation still apply to everyone. The subconscious mind and the forces of nature don't suspend their operating instructions to accommodate inequality or unfairness, genocide or slavery. They simply respond to the frequencies embedded in our words and go about organizing reality accordingly. There are no exceptions to the reality creation game. It doesn't matter how justified we think our victim stories are. Identifying with victimhood keeps us disempowered. while ensuring that we continue to manifest unfair licks in our lives. And so while no one is denying the sucky lot that various groups and individuals endure, the only way for all of us to transmute inequality, unfairness, and suckiness is to stop identifying with it. So there are two points I want to make here, and then I think we might go back to it. We'll see how it goes. A couple things have come up with my clients and friends that, which is why we're going into victimhood. I want to talk about the inclination to spiritual bypass. So I have one client who is a badass, right? And she will not victimize herself. And she has had plenty of experiences that, according to most people, would justify quite a lot of victimization. But she doesn't want anything to do with that. And I have a lot of respect for her unwillingness to victimize herself to her circumstances. That being said, she is currently undergoing some pretty challenging circumstances. But what I've noticed is there's a reticence to acknowledge that it's hard. There's a reticence to connect with some of the darker emotions that have organically come up because of what she's going through. That's not what I'm advocating for, and that's not ultimately a healthy place, a healthy way for us to deal with our challenges. We all go through things that are hard. Pretending that it's not hard can be a bypass, right? Now, if if I'm doing some heavy lifting with friends, that's straining my back, in the moment I'm not going to complain about it, right? Because it's just going to make the task at hand harder. But let's say the next day my back's really hurting and I could use some body work. I'm not going to pretend like it's not hurting and just go do some hard physical stuff that's really not in alignment, given my back situation, right? It's like we have to hold it all gently, right? So it's like, sucky stuff happens. Of course, sucky stuff happens. And as healthy, emotionally mature adults, we acknowledge some of the darker emotions that they bring up, and we allow ourselves to feel those emotions fully. But once we've felt them fully, then we don't attach. We let them go, right? Or we trust that they're going to fade away or transmute themselves of their own accord. But if we're not acknowledging the hard time we're having, we're skipping a really important step. And that's where we get into emotional repression, which creates disease in the body, right? So I would say, you know, one of the most important reasons to acknowledge the hurt feelings when they come up is to keep our bodies healthy so that we're not like storing these backlogs of unfelt, unacknowledged emotions, which will then, you know, back up on us in terms of dis-ease, pathologies, conflict in our relationships, negative belief systems, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So we want to feel them, but we just don't want to linger, which brings me to my next piece. So I have a friend who, she runs a lot of victim consciousness. Like, there's just no way around it. And I'm not saying anything here to all of you guys that I haven't said to her directly. I'm not a fan of gossip. I feel like gossip is one of the most caustic, destructive energies, especially when it comes to community. No good comes of gossip. So I'm not a fan of saying things about people that I would not feel comfortable saying to them. And I'm especially not a fan of saying things about people that I haven't first address with them directly. That's just like basic human respect 101. But the reason I bring it up is because there have been some incidents lately that has this friend of mine kind of amping up the victim consciousness. And what I've heard her say over and over in defending the victim consciousness is, I have a right to be hurt. I have a right to be hurt. You can understand why I'm hurt, right? But the problem is that she keeps doubling down on the hurt and brandishing the hurt to everyone who will listen to the story, Which just keeps her in the energy of the hurt, keeps her in the frequency of the hurt, makes her an energetic match for more similar hurt, which I am observing happening. But it's also like we only like keep brandishing our hurt for pity points when we have not ourselves processed and integrated said hurt. So again, I go back to this this misunderstanding of authority, which I think is like root cause of so many of the issues that we're dealing with now. Whereas every time my friend tries to rope me into this old story that I'm super bored of because I've heard it about 20 times, and I've told her like I've hit the wall in enabling this. I'm not enabling this anymore, which has us at a little bit of an impasse in our friendship, right? But like I was just feeling so out of integrity with the work that I do to be enabling someone else's victimhood. But what it is it's vampiric, right? It's like an energy vampire. It's like I don't have the self-responsibility, the awareness, or the courage to deal with my own pain. So I'm just going to keep telling you about my pain so you can pity me, so you can give me the compassion that I'm not willing to give myself. No. No, 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 no. When we enable that behavior in others, we're enabling their immaturity and their emotional retardation, and we are empowering their own victimhood, which is not something I feel comfortable doing. So I want to read us a little bit about the narcissism of victimhood, just to get a deeper understanding, and then we'll get into the specific languaging pattern that I'm talking about. So quickly, because my last solo podcast was about identification, I just want to share this piece just to help, you know, since that's kind of fresh with all of us at the Word Up podcast, I think it's a great place to apply our deepening understanding of identification in terms of the victimization conversation. So everyone undergoes experiences and indignities to which we can, if we so choose, victimize ourselves. How tightly we cling to these experiences and indignities is what determines whether we victimize ourselves to them or not. Victimhood has nothing to do with what we experience, rather how we choose to frame and language our experiences. And I want to pause and just say it a different way. Victimhood has nothing to do with what happened to us. Victimhood has everything to do with how we talk about what happened to us. That is the only difference. And I think, excuse me, I think a lot of people running victim consciousness don't understand, right? And this is kind of the thing with all of us. And this is why I created the body of work that I did, where it's like, you know I'm stuck. I know that I'm I'm sabotaging myself in certain ways. I know I'm getting in my own way, but I don't know how. Right? For me, it always goes back to the language. Let me look at the language to figure out how I'm sabotaging myself. And so specifically when we're talking about victimhood, victimhood is 100% about the words we are ascribing to our objectively neutral experiences. It's just about the languaging. That languaging is what programs our belief systems, which has us buying into the identity construct of being victims. And that sets up our entire frequency to be a frequency match with the larger frequency band in the morphogenetic field called victimhood, which is why those running victim consciousness will manifest situation after situation wherein they get to be victims, because that's how they're programming their reality with the words they're ascribing to their otherwise neutral experiences. Okay. When we identify with our traumas or our shadows or our challenges, we victimize ourselves to them. Victimization isn't determined by being discriminated against or having a terrible thing perpetrated upon us. Victimization is determined by how we author our stories, interpret our experiences, and choose to perceive the world. By and large, those of us who claim to be victims and who are stuck in victim consciousness are not victims because life has given us an unfair shake or because others are doing terrible things to us, but because we are habitually identifying ourselves as victims and utilizing the language of victimhood to describe our experiences. When we identify as victims, we don't just program our internal frequencies to configure themselves to victimhood. We align ourselves with victimhood frequency bands in the morphic field, thereby setting up a feedback loop that attracts perpetrators and experiences that will continue to affirm our self-proclaimed victimhood. All right. So then we go into, okay, so then the next part is the victim perpetrator polarity. I'm gonna skip that. I'm gonna take a sip. How about that? This is kind of the biggest thing I noticed with the solo podcast. I get really dizzy and lightheaded. I have historically gotten really dizzy and lightheaded, hence these constant reminders to drink water. All right, I'm building up my stamina. Okay, so victim goggles. At any given moment, there are infinite morsels of input and objects and nuance and circumstance that are amalgamating to create our experience of reality. There are buildings and weather and soundscapes. There are flashes of color and texture, along with snippets of conversation. There are insects and clouds and chemtrails. There are birds and honking horns. There are walls and window frames and billboards and telephone wires. There is a horizon. The human sensory apparatus can only take in but a tiny fraction of the myriad elements competing for our awareness in any given moment. Language determines how our brains filter this endless onslaught of input, as well as the meaning we will project upon it. This meaning will consistently confirm the stories and egoic projections that are coded into our identity constructs, as well as the languaging habits informing them. Reality and all the elements and experiences that comprise it is fundamentally neutral. It is our own personal programming that will determine whether we judge our experience as good, bad, right, wrong, fair, unfair, etc. The words we habitually use and the stories we consistently tell determine our outlook on the world and whether we will surmise that world to be kind, loving, fair, fucked up, or out to get us. As the language of identification consistently distorts our lens of perception to affirm the stories that beget our identity constructs, identifying as a victim is tantamount to gluing a pair of victim goggles to one's face and then perpetually seeing the world through victimhood tinted lenses. When observing the world through victim goggles, otherwise neutral experiences and exchanges become tinged with ill will, nefarious intentions, and implied omniscience. When I am operating in victim consciousness and the waiter forgets to bring me a side of lemon, it's not because he's slammed, stoned, or incompetent, it's because he's an anti-Semite. It doesn't matter that I don't actually know the waiter or that I have zero evidence that the waiter holds any ill will towards Jews or even knows that I'm Jewish. Because I am seeing the world through victim goggles, I am operating with a duly distorted lens of perception, which has me interpreting otherwise neutral interactions to fit my victim narrative. I have a couple of other examples here, but I think you guys are getting the picture, and I'm just gonna leave it with, It's not just the folks who are choosing to victimize themselves to circumstance. It's not just that folks who are choosing to victimize themselves to circumstance are operating through distorted lenses, which bend reality to fit their programming. It's that they are also allegedly all-knowing psychics. In all of our examples, the victims were able to clairvoyantly read the perpetrator's internal motivations and to know they were operating out of nefarious intent. Now, I'm going to skip the imaginary omniscience of victimhood section. And I'm just going to talk to us about the narcissism of victimhood. I had thought that I had a chapter here about the narcissism of victimhood. And it's fine. So the thing with victimhood is when we're running victim stories, we are placing ourselves front and center of everyone else's story, right? It's all about us. So what I've noticed about victim languaging and victim consciousness is that it takes. It needs everyone else's energy, attention, validation, compassion, and empathy while we paint ourselves front and center in everyone else's story. It is ridiculous, which is why I go the distance to not enable that type of victim consciousness, because I don't want to be bled dry. And that's how it feels to me when I'm on the receiving end of victim consciousness. It's like there is an implied script that I'm supposed to be reading from, wherein the person running victim consciousness is, you know, this person did this to me, I had to do this, they made me do this, I can't do this, victim, victim, victim. And then the implied script is I'm supposed to be like, oh, well, that's too bad. And I'm supposed to do the big pity eyes. And I'm supposed to ooze compassion and empathy and, you know, pat their head and scratch behind their ears and like help them feel better instead of supporting them in doing their own work, in self-sourcing their own empathy, their own compassion, pulling themselves up by those proverbial bootstraps and getting back in the game. So, and then there's this, the omniscience part is like, I mean, it's happened so many times. The example that's popping to mind now, and I know I've mentioned this multiple times, was in 2012, I published an article about gender reassignment surgery as seen through the lens of the 53rd gene key. And I specified multiple times in that article, I have no issue with individuals who are choosing to go through gender reassignment surgery. And because one of my guiding, you know, a number one values is freedom, I will fight to the death for someone's freedom to have that surgery while at the same time personally thinking there's probably an easier way. So a blogger who has made an entire career for itself, I don't want to get into the pronoun thing, so we're just going to go there, which is, and I'm interrupting myself with this thought, one of the other reasons why the pronoun game is so fundamentally dehumanizing, because I see people getting so hung up around the pronouns that those who aren't willing to play that game will, by default, unconsciously remove the humanity from the equation by using the it pronoun. And I know I'm not the only one doing this. I've heard it on multiple podcasts. And again, I'm not doing it to be disrespectful. It's just like the whole thing is such an opaque, fragmenting cluster poop of, you know, mind control and chaos and confusion that I want no part of, that I'll just go to it to shorthand it, because God forbid we use the wrong gender and wind up in freaking prison, you know, the way they're doing in other countries right now. It's crazy. But so this being made a career for itself by putting itself into new age, it seemed to be primarily new age experiences like a yoga retreat or a meditation retreat. And then because this being was running victim consciousness, had victim goggles verily glued to its face, it would then go out and do these like big, you know, explosive, bombastic blogs about how everyone was transphobic and everyone's homophobic and everyone hates this being, blah, 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 blah. So that's exactly what happened after this article came out. And there was, you know, this whole attack on Twitter back in 2012. And I was accused of being transphobic and hateful and this and that. And it's like, I'm not even like, you're not on my radar. I'm not talking to you. I don't like you and I don't not like you. I don't hate you and I don't love you because I don't know you and you're not on my radar. And it's not all about you, king, queen, victims. Like, the world does not revolve around you and your unresolved hurt. That's my annoyance with these people running victim consciousness. So frustrating, right? So someone's, you know, misgendered online, and then it gets turned into this thing. They hate me. They're trying to hurt me. It's like, no, you're really not that important. And they don't even know about you. And they're not even thinking about you. And that's a lot harder for people to wrestle with, the fact that they're not top of people's minds, than their preferred story, which is that they are top of everyone's mind and everyone hates them because they're that important to all these people. It's delusional. Victimhood is so delusional. So, coming back to my friend, the victim stuff has been like extremely activated. Now, I know some of us are super stubborn. I am one of those people who's super stubborn. So sometimes, very often, I will need to pick a pattern to a really kind of exaggerated, overblown, ugly place before the pushback is painful enough to inspire me to shift, to transform. And so I respect other people who roll that way. We're all on our own timeline. You know, not everyone's gonna transmute victim consciousness in this lifetime. It's unfortunate. I don't think it's realistic, right? It's one room schoolhouse, as Guru Singh said. We're not all ready for that. But it did hit this crescendo with this one friend of mine where I was just like, I'm not doing this. Like, I'm not signing on to any of these stories. I'm hearing your version of the story, but I'm not hearing where you're taking responsibility, where you contributed, because you seem to be the through line in all these stories. And I'm going to share a very benign example, which is what brings us to the actual meat of the matter today. Yes, we buried the lead pretty deep in, which is have to. And so this friend of mine had some sort of injury going on. And in the long string of voice memos I was getting, it's like, and I can't ride my bike, or I have to ride my bike and it really hurts and I'm in so much pain. And I was just hearing this have to, and I was like, well, then why don't you don't have to ride your bike at all. You could totally call an Uber and have your own back. And then she went into, but I don't want to take an Uber, but I want to ride my bike. And I'm like, okay, so you don't have to ride your bike. You're choosing to ride your bike because it's your preference to ride your bike, because you're in choice as an empowered being, and there's no have to here. Now, this is a friend. This is not someone who is of their own volition coming to me for my two cents on where they're sabotaging themselves, right? So it's a fine line. And if there was one languaging upgrade I could give to everyone on the planet that will absolutely, positively change your life, that is transmute all of your have-tos and find a way to reverse engineer your every alleged have-to into choice. Because when we're in choice, we are attuned to the frequency bands of empowerment in the morphogenetic field. When I am in have to, I am claiming I have no authority, I have no agency, some sort of external force is the boss of me, and I am enslaved to the whims of said external force. And every time I say I have to, I am attuning myself to the frequency band of disempowerment and victimhood, thus casting my vote for more disempowerment and more victimhood in my life and directing the forces of reality creation to bring me perpetrators, to bring me circumstances wherein I get to know myself as a victim, wherein I get to know myself as disempowered. Every word matters. It's not a throwaway line that I say every word matters. I say every word matters because it's true. Every single word I think, I speak, I type, I text, I journal about myself is functioning to program my subconscious mind and to program the larger collective reality construct that we are all contributing to. Have to is never true when we're talking about free beings. Now, if we're talking about a slave who is literally shackled to a chain gang or being beaten or having hands laid on them, that's legit victimhood. That's legit have to, right? But this is a small percentage, a tiny, tiny, tiny infinitesimal percentage of the times when have to is actually appropriate. So, you know, I've constantly used the example, I have to go to work, right? No, I don't have to go to work. I choose to work because I like income, because I like money, because I like having a fridge full of food. Even this, you know, I started off this conversation by saying, I'm still in the process of transmuting ambivalence and discomfort around solo podcasting, right? I don't have to solo podcast on any level. I am choosing to solo podcast because I'm choosing to take advantage of this platform as a means of A, growing my own comfort and skill and mastery with the longer form solo podcasts. Primarily, the reason why I choose to solo podcast is it gives me an opportunity to go really deep into my quantum languaging work and to spend more time unpacking these concepts so that they land better with people, so that people are inspired to not just buy my books and my courses, but to start utilizing this work so that they can transform themselves and our world for the better. For me to have the impact on culture that I would like to have, that I'm, you know, am committed to having, that is inviting me to do things like solo podcasts. But if I sit down to do this podcast and I say, oh, I have to solo podcast, right? Say a friend's like, hey, Danny, do you want to have lunch? No, I can't. I have to podcast today. Then that frequency of disempowerment and victimhood, A, is going to pervade the podcast itself, right? You guys will feel that energy, that kind of reticence, that kind of whiny, like, oh, Danny isn't really here. She's half-assing it because she doesn't want to be here. But it's also going to be an instance of me casting my vote in the morphogenetic field for more disempowerment and more victimhood. And all I'm casting my vote for is more empowerment, more agency, more love, more fun, more abundance, more joy, more magic, more play, right? And so because those are the experiences that I'm calling in, where I have free will, where I have power in that, is to speak those frequencies. And the more I speak those frequencies, the more I take action in alignment with those frequencies, the easier it's going to be for the reality creation forces to give me those experiences and give me more of those frequencies, because it's a match. Like frequencies attract like frequencies. Tesla told us this. Einstein told us this. It's the basis for quantum physics, right? So, and this is my issue with the whole like social justice movement. It's like, all the doubling down on all of the past atrocities is serving to seed, you know, those individual realities and our collective reality with more and more of those kinds of atrocities. I mean, look at what is happening in our culture right now with the oppression Olympics. It started with Black Lives Matter, right? And when I first heard of Black Lives Matter in 2012, I was writing for Reality Sandwich, and that was the publication that ran the gender reassignment surgery piece. And I went to my editor, Ken, who I actually just found out this morning has passed. So blessings, a call, Ken Jordan wishing so much grace and ease in your onward journeyings home. But it was that man, Ken, who said, I went to him, I said, look, I want to write a piece about this languaging Black Lives Matter, because this languaging is only seeding our reality with more racism, and I guarantee this is going to create more racism. That was my last pitch to Reality Sandwich, because Ken said, we can't take it anymore. He said, I can't take it anymore. As a white guy, you know, as editor, I'm the one who's going to deal with the pushback, and I don't want to take this on. So no. But noticed what has happened to race relations in this country since that, whatever that is, hit the scene, right? We were past this. We were past this in the 80s. We were past this in the 90s. This wasn't a thing. It became a thing by bringing up the past transgressions, carrying them from the past into our present so that we could, you know, off-gas those gross toxic frequencies into our current reality structure. Same thing is happening right now over this stupid Jew anti-Semite thing that I want no part of. This was part, you know, one of the first rifts I had with my family was when everyone got email and everyone started doing these group emails, and I was getting all these like Zionist, you know, pro-Israel, you know, how tragic Bo Bagic, feel sorry for Jews emails. And I was like, take me off this list. Like, I'm not really interested in embracing some victim story about Jews that has nothing to do with my lived present day experience in the 21st century. Like, I don't need to harp on things that I wasn't alive for and that I'm not witnessing in my everyday life, because I want to live an empowered life of choice and awesomeness, not a victim life of sucky crap, right? So that's how that, all of that works. So thanks so much for tuning in to this first half of today's podcast. As you are inspired to pick up the second half, you can find that over on both my Patreon and Locals communities. Those addresses are dannykatz.locals.com and patreon.com/dannykatz. I'm also reminding you to subscribe to my newsletter at dannykatz.com. It's the best way to ensure that we get to stay in touch in light of whatever big tech shenanigans are happening out there. And as you are inspired to learn more about my work, my books, my webinars, my brand new Pop Propaganda Digital Media Literacy course for teens and grownups alike, as you're wanting to learn more about working with me one-on-one in the coaching capacity or bringing me into your organization as a languaging expert/consultant, you can find all of that at dannykatz.com as well as quantumlanguaging.com. I think that does it for housekeeping. I'll see you over on the private communities. Thanks so much for paying attention. Thank you for remembering that every word matters, that you are omniscopic amazingness. Have a rockin' day.
And for clicking that subscribe button, for liking, for sharing, for commenting, and for leaving some kind words as a review, as you are authentically inspired, as you are receiving any value from my podcast, as you dig it, as you listen regularly, consider supporting me on Patreon and or Locals, where for as little as $5 a month, you get access to all of my second half podcast interviews, as well as oodles of bonus content. Your support really goes a long way in supporting me as a journalist and an independent content creator navigate her way through a really crunchy time in terms of free speech. And as you are wanting to learn more about my work in the world, my books, my products, my quantum languaging coaching and consulting, you can find me at dannykatz.com. as well as quantumlanguaging.com. And if you're not down with a membership patronage platform and want to send me one-time donation, you can use the Bitcoin link if it actually appears on your podcast listening platform. You could also send me a one-time donation by way of PayPal at dannykatz@pm.me. or by way of Venmo, where my username is Sadie Bloom. Again, your support means the world and makes a massive, massive difference when it comes to continuing to share this work with the world. Thank you for sharing your sacred attention with me. Thank you for remembering that you are omniscopic amazingness and for having a rockin' day. See you next time, superstars.